You're listening to RIA Radio, the nationally trusted name in real estate investing. We dig deep to discover investors' why in real estate. If you want to skip all the BS and get in investors' heads, you're in the right spot. Be one of the thousands to check out RIAradio.com. Welcome to RIA Radio, episode 118 with Ashley Kerr. Okay, Owen, after interviewing Ashley, I am dead set that we need to go buy that building down the street and create a liquor store.
Totally. Like, this was a really fun episode because we talked about Ashley has a business mind and how she has basically gone and created a not only a small real estate empire, but also has experimented with exploring different business opportunities, including a liquor store, which you're going to hear about in this episode. And it's just fascinating. And we talk about a little bit of the whole, how do you corral your shiny object syndrome with, making smart business decisions while at the same time keeping your eye on the ball. And it was a fun conversation. And I think it's just going to be really cool to hear about how this all came about. Like a liquor store in Buffalo, New York, and she lives on a dairy farm or lived on a dairy farm and has grown her, her social media platform to a point where she got noticed by Bigger Pockets. And
intentionally though.
Yeah. Yeah. She had a plan.
Wasn't by accident.
That's true. Yeah. She had a plan to go about that. She got featured on Bigger Pockets and then ended up being asked to host the Bigger Pockets Rookie podcast, which is obviously a big deal. So for those of you not familiar with Ashley Kerr, you're about to be. And she is a really, really fun person to talk to just in general about all kinds of stuff. This was a wide-ranging episode. We talked about her life, her early, goings on in real estate, and eventually how she has, parlayed that into success in commercial and residential investments. Her maybe some failures along the way that are going to be kind of unique and fun to, hear some of the stories that she has.
I didn't feel like, a lot of times you interview these large, influencers. I feel like all the responses are just automated. This is something we talk about quite a bit. And Ashley was definitely, just flowing
with genuine. Yeah. She was, not canned responses to a lot of the stuff. Yeah. So I do want to give us, kudos ourselves here for our skillful interviewing along the way to tease out some of these details that you've never heard before. So that's, we got to give ourselves a little credit.
I mean, totally give us a lot of credit.
Yeah, well, we also like credit in the form of 5-star reviews. So if you haven't done that recently, we would really enjoy
or a written 5-star review. We haven't had a written review in
either
minute,
or too. Yes, or both.
But I also haven't checked in probably about 2 weeks.
That's true.
So I need to
get off your ass, Ted.
What's been new with you? Have you sat down with anybody fun and exciting? Like, are people still hitting you up that for those little coffee interviews?
Oh, this is actually pretty interesting. So I was asking you this earlier, but in today's episode with Ashley, we talked about one of her business ventures that she had was starting an insurance agency. And it didn't go according to plan and didn't end up being like something that she's still involved in. But I had lunch the other day with an attorney locally here who is engaged to a friend of ours, Rene Benoit, and really, really cool guy, Justin. And we had lunch. We sat down. He had this idea about.
I see him at my gym all the time.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, way to drop that in there about your gym activities. Anyway, Ted's a gym influencer all of a sudden.
You got you got bigger muscles than me, buddy.
So anyway, Justin had this idea about starting an insurance company that was investor centric. So basically, how do we go about solving this problem of huge increases in insurance policy prices for investors? How can we go about solving for that? And the fact that, let's be honest here, it seems like there's a ton of money that's made by insurance companies. And anytime there's any encroachment on that, because there's a lot of claims paid out, they jack the prices to a point where it's just like, oh my God, it's devastating
that,
sometimes.
That affordable housing is almost impossible.
It is, exactly. Well said. And so anyway, the point being on this, we had a lunch meeting and, we were just kind of exploring the ideas, and he's got experience in litigating insurance cases, has a ton of insight in that. Just really, really, really smart dude. Just like crazy smart guy. So we talked about kind of ideas around that and how it might look if you put together an insurance company that catered to investors specifically. And I know this has been attempted before, but in a way that's not cost prohibitive. So, you know, we're talking about that. So that was super fun and interesting. And just like, it's always great meeting with, you know, smart people and the ideas that kind of come across out of that.
You know, that just made me think of something, you know, how the government is trying to aggressively get Section 8 housing and there's just not enough housing for Section 8. Okay, government, pay attention. This is my idea that I just came up with. Offer the full package. Offer, when you do Section 8, offer a special insurance program, home insurance for your Section 8 people. So it provides some incentives to do to work with Section 8, like where it's either free or discounted in that program. Because if that was out there, I'd definitely be looking at Section 8. And also maybe offer a special interest rate financing program for people to do Section 8 also. So if you really want to build Section 8, offer insurance, offer financing, and guess what? The investors will come.
Yeah, and I think you know, there's more to this too that I think is going to – there's going to be some changes that happen here in the next few years, probably the next 2-3 years. And, you know, depending on what happens with the election and all that in 2024, that could dictate some of this. But I think there's with all of the flux going on in costs and inflation and everything else, and affordable housing being in the limelight with the media and, you know, all kinds of, you know, politicians, it's a thing, right? So they're making it more and more difficult in a lot of municipalities to actually provide affordable housing because of all the red tape. So removing a lot of that red tape would go a long way toward, you know, paving the way to a soft landing for investors to actually provide affordable housing, because there's really no benefit right now. It's just making it, it's just basically like, hey, what are you doing to provide affordable housing? And but you're like, I'm going to make this so difficult for you that you're just going to give up and pursue something else that's more lucrative and easier.
Well, and if the government can't get together and balance the damn budget, and when they every time they close the government, if you have Section 8 housing, you're not getting paid until that's all figured out. So you're at the mercy of them.
Yeah. Anyway, so I don't think we figure anything out on today's podcast, but we're trying to work toward it. And like, I think the more, you know, conversations that happen between people that are investing in real estate and have ideas on how we can, you know, put more housing output for the people that, you know, can't afford luxury living and can't afford $1,500 for a studio apartment. Those are in the Midwest. So those are the challenges we're trying to solve. So, you know, I don't know. Like, I think we need more ideas and less red tape. And that's going to be the, you know, solution here, and making it more beneficial for people to bring those units online, because it's just not profitable right now. And that's the way that you're going to get incentivized people to, you know, bring more of those units on.
And if you work for the government and you want to talk to Owen and I on the podcast or personally about our advice, we would be happy to meet with you and give you the advice on how to actually do this.
Absolutely. Reach out, yo.
But here's the one thing, just to finish that. It's like, if you do Section 8 housing, you have a Section 8 checkup on your house, an inspection every few months, right?
Yeah.
But if you're in the city in Omaha, you're also going to get a City of Omaha inspection. So you're going to get double inspected. Why? You're already Section 8 inspected. That's one of the things that just mind boggles me. Figure that out, people.
Yeah, like get on the same page. It's kind of like the what is it, the all the government agencies like the FBI, the CIA, the DOD, like none of them share information with each other. It's so like compartmentalized. So be helpful if people are like, we're on the same page. This has already been done, guys. There's no need to do it again. We've already done it. So yeah, it's just removing red tape. I think it's going to go a long way here.
Should we run for office?
No.
Okay, good.
I will support you when you run. Today's Golden Nugget is brought to you by JM Real Estate Capital.
Hi, it's Rob, JM Real Estate Capital. We're the money guys that you need to know for all your real estate investments. Talk to us. We can do what your local bank can't or won't do. We don't have millions. We have trillions with a T to lend. 844-WE-CLOSE or go online, jmrecapital.com. That's jmrecapital.com. JM Real Estate Capital, smart solutions for the real estate investor.
golden nugget. Today's golden nugget. I wanted to re-explore this topic. We have talked about this. I know it's been a long time, I think, but we talked a while back about real estate jobs that are, if you're trying to become a real estate investor, what's going to be a good way for you to get experience without actually putting money out there and putting yourself at risk without having knowledge? And we talk about this a little bit in the episode today with Ashley, but wanted to just kind of like explore this topic a little bit with you, Ted, and see, you know, what your ideas are. I know in the episode we talk about property management in particular being a really good skill set to learn when you're dealing with, you know, residents and how to manage a property effectively, all the, you know, costs and income associated with it and so forth. What other real estate adjacent jobs or like real estate industry jobs do you think are beneficial for people to get?
Well, whenever anybody asks me this question of what I should get involved with to start real estate, and if you're past the books and you're in a position that you can just take a regular random job, I always suggest the property management side, because you get to see the leasing, you get to see what the rents are, you get to understand evaluating rents. I mean, understanding a lease is really important. and then you get to know the parts of your town, what the rents could potentially be for, go for it. I am a firm believer that if you are like 21 years old or young and you don't have a lot of bills on your back and you just want to learn the industry, I totally think that joining a property management company is the number one thing you could do. Otherwise, you could volunteer at your local REIA group and get to know the investors.
Well, no, it's interesting you say that, because everything you just said was related to the back office of property management. Right. So you're talking about analysis, rent, like market rent, and doing, you know, a lot of those activities. But it's also customer service. Like that's one of the major components of property management, which if you can learn really good customer service skills, that can overcome a lot of your shortcomings in other areas. If you just admit, like, and this is, I'm going to liken this to if you go out to a restaurant. So if you get somebody, you know, that's waiting on your table, let's say they mess up a couple of things, but they're super attentive and they make sure you're taken care of. And they're like, how is everything? And they're like really good at the customer service aspect. That will trump all day long, like the technical issues that are happening on the back end, I think. Would you agree with that?
If I could push my kids, even if they don't want to be real estate investors, to do two jobs before they get into being an adult, I would push them to be some sort of sales opportunity, learn sales, and some sort of service industry, bartender, waitress, waiter, whatever. But I think between those two jobs, it really rounds you for life.
I totally agree with you. And this is coming from a former bartender. I know you managed a bar.
I've been a bartender.
Yeah. I think learning customer service skills. And I think when you are a good customer service person, it's a lot easier to learn sales skills as well. So they kind of go hand in hand, because you have to be good with people. And I think a lot of times people are like, oh, I'm not good at sales. Like, I don't like sales. I don't like convincing people. I don't like that whole process. But it's more like identifying. It's listening, asking the right questions, and basically, you know, describing a solution for problems that people have. That's sales 101. But I think people have this conception of like you're browbeating somebody that's walking in to try and buy a car or look at a car, and you're just beating the crap out of them with like negotiating tactics. That's not it at all. It's like solving someone's problem in a way that makes it really easy for them. That's, I think, the number one issue with customer service and sales.
If I look at my all my jobs, as you like to give me a hard time about, over my lifetime, I would say that 90% of the jobs that I've done in my lifetime has always been sales or service industry.
Yeah.
And it definitely has molded me to be able to be, you know, better with the customers and a better listener.
Well, yeah. And I think, and not to, you know, beat a dead horse here, but if you can learn sales skills in a way that isn't slimy. And that's what I think a lot of people have the misconception about, is like, you know, oh, if I'm going to be good at sales, I have to be like really convincing and like try to browbeat somebody into doing something they don't want to do. That's not the case at all. It's just solving problems. But I think, you know, like just kind of like finish putting a bow on this topic with regard to learning the real estate industry, obviously becoming a licensed real estate agent is extremely beneficial for a lot of different reasons. I never went that route. You did go that route. We have landed in similar territories with investing in real estate, but you also have, like, you know, Ted has, he's got brokerage in his background. He's been a real estate broker, a real estate salesperson. He's supplemented his, you know, livelihood or his, lifestyle income through selling real estate and transacting. I've supplemented my real estate income or my household income by buying and selling real estate. So there's different facets of this. And let's say you're like, you know what? I don't want to be an agent. I don't want to be a property manager. All I want to do is buy and sell. I want to flip houses and just be a monster. Well, guess what? Here's the way you go about this. You can do a couple of things I think are going to shortcut your pathway to becoming that role or becoming a person that's proficient in that role. And the first is, you know, join your local RIA real estate meetup, any conglomeration or any group of people that are getting together that are in real estate investing. Go to those things, start getting to know those people. So let's say you are not able to, or you don't want to go out and go to these meetups or local RIAs or whatever. How can you find out who the active local flippers are in your community? Because let's say you want to go work for them. You want to learn about transacting real estate. You want to learn about motivated sellers. You want to go out and get some experience, you know, going on these appointments. You have no desire to be a property manager or be involved in managing property. Let's say you want to be in transactional real estate. What would be your approach?
I would find the local real estate meetup group on Facebook. And I would get in the search bar and look up flippers if I was looking for flippers or flipping. And then once I found a couple people that posted their flips on there, then I would look at the comments and then see who commented, who obviously is their friends, maybe reach out on and get it slipping in their DMs of their friends or the people that actually did the flips and then start asking some questions or ask to take them out for lunch. And in that lunch comment, for me, I'm a cigar guy. So if somebody reached out to me and my DMs like, "Hey man, I'm going to buy you an old fashioned cigar." That's going to be more appealing than somebody just hit me up for my information. So, you know, or if you have something to offer, like, "Hey, this is what I do, and maybe I can benefit your business." So offer a value.
I love that. And I would say, so I would add on to what you just said with, let's say you're starting totally cold. You move to a new city. You're like, "I just need to get the lay of the land here, figure out who's what." Join your local, you know, Facebook group. So if you have a real estate meetup in, let's say it's Omaha, Nebraska or Tacoma, Washington or, you know, wherever, Alabama, doesn't matter. Just Google your city and then real estate investing. And then you're probably going to have some stuff that pops up. Join those groups, whether it's RIA, real estate investing group, whatever it is. And then get active in that group, find out who's participating. But also what you can do is if you just go to Google, type in real estate investing and then whatever your city name is, or you can type in "we buy houses" and then your city name. Google that. Whatever pops up in your search results is going to be the people that are paying to have their advertisements out there. So there's going to be generally three people at the top of that list that are paid. You know, it's going to say sponsored, and then it'll have names of real estate companies. And if you click on those, or, you know, if you want to be nice, you can actually scroll down and not make them pay for your click. But you can find out who those businesses are and then, reach out to them. Like, so they're going to have an email address. They're going to have a phone number in there. Reach out to them and say, "I want to work for your company. Here are, you know, like, here's what I'm looking to do. I really want to be a real estate investor. I could drive for dollars. I could be and driving for dollars, by the way, for those that don't know, is you drive around a neighborhood, you take note of houses that are in disrepair, you make a note of the address and so forth, take pictures of it and whatnot. But
also just reach out to your local RIA owner. That there's a RIA in every city pretty much. Just reach out to them. I probably get 20 people reach out to me every single month or week and just asking for leads and it's every week. I get at least 20 people reach out just because I run the RIA page or have the local RIA. So just find the owner of that local page, hit them up, tell them what your goal is, and they will probably direct you. When you run pages like this, you're it's because you're a connector, that's your trait. I put people in touch. I've probably given, no kidding, 20 lead sources just in the last 24 hours. And while I'm sitting here and getting my 19 text messages during our podcast, three of them were thanking me for the leads I sent over.
Oh, so, perfect example. So yeah, just put in the work. These are just examples of things you can do to get some experience, get your feet, on the ground with regard to real estate investing, make some connections and so forth. So get out there, take some action. These are the types of professions that you can get into to make yourself a good real estate investor.
Yeah. So great tips, and pay attention to the next podcast that we're about to put out with Ashley Care.
Ashley Care.
Welcome to RIA Radio, episode 118 with Ashley Care.
Nice. Well done. Ted, I told you I'm kind of a grammar Nazi. So Ted, the part of our little banter is normally Ted mispronouncing guests' names and me correcting him on it and us laughing for a while about it. So good job, Ted. Ashley, I was curious. So I know, and we'll definitely get into your origin story and how you kind of came to be the prolific Bigger Pockets rookie podcast host and published author, and I don't want to steal all of your thunder here, but I wanted to explore the idea of, in kind of doing a little bit of research on your background, I know you've have a couple of different businesses other than real estate, and I wanted to maybe talk about why you're doing that and maybe kind of, you always hear the dangers of the shiny object syndrome, but obviously you're successful in your own right in real estate investing. But how did you come to be a liquor store owner is something that I really wanted to know.
Because he secretly wants to own one.
Exactly. Yeah. For selfish reasons.
Yeah. There is a video out there that is me rapping to Nicki Minaj. It's like the song Bottoms Up, where she's like, I don't need Trey to buy me rosé. And it's me holding up my liquor license the day I got it. And I'm rapping that part because I don't need Trey to buy me my rosé. I have my liquor license. I can get it myself.
Well, we are for sure going to research that and put it in the show notes. So you're going to be Instagram famous here again soon. But how did that happen? Mind spinning the story for us?
Sure. And this kind of starts with my real estate origin. I started working for my childhood best friend, her dad. I started working for him, and he had a bunch of businesses and some commercial real estate. And I never knew how much he had really growing up. But then once I started working for him, I was like, wow, there's actually a lot of different stuff going on here. And one of the things was he had a liquor store. And so I always just watched it be this cash cow. So there was this building that I wanted to buy, and it was a mixed-use building. It would be my first commercial property. It had two commercial downstairs and two residential upstairs. And the guy that was selling a bunch of other properties. So at the time, I didn't know what to do with that building. I just always loved it and wanted it. I literally put it on my Christmas wish list for like 2 years. But it didn't make sense to buy it at that time. And they wanted $90,000 for it. And I bought the rest of his properties. I bought the other portfolio. 2 years later, the son approached me and said, my dad's got to get rid of this property. We'll sell it to you for $60,000, I think it was. And so I went and looked at it again. And he's like, we do also have this other duplex too we need to get rid of. And so I said, okay, I will take them both for $40,000 because the one needed a new roof.
This is like blue light special at Walmart. They're like, oh, in aisle 7, we also have a duplex for $40,000 if you would like to have that.
So the 2 years before that, it had been 90. They dropped it to 60 2 years later, and then I negotiated a 40. But I didn't want this duplex. It had an old grocery store. It had been in the bottom of it. And so there was really only one residential. And then the downstairs, it was like in a residential neighborhood. No business would want to go in there. So I wholesaled that for $20,000. So this 4-unit now had cost me $20,000 because I was patient and I waited. So I was thinking at that price, I can be a little risky as to what I want to do with it. So I talked to one of my partners. We had a couple properties together at that point, and he was also engaged to be married to the investor I was working for's daughter. So there was some kind of relation there. So he also knew about the liquor store, things like that. So in New York State, they, when someone wants to get their liquor license for a liquor store, they do some research as to making sure that there's enough there's not too much competition and that there's enough to service the area or whatever. So they go and do like a study to kind of look at the radius, how many liquor stores are actually close. And like, no, this is too many. So I pinpointed the two towns in that county, and one of them ended up being where I had bought this building. So I approached my partner and I said, do you want to do this? I said, I already got the building. I got a great deal on it. Help me rehab it. We can split the renovation costs and we'll start a liquor store in there. So we had no idea what we were doing, but we paid my mentor, the investor I was working for, paid him or his liquor store manager to help us with it. So we would just pay her like almost like a consulting fee. We hired a liquor license broker who took care of the whole liquor license process for us. You know, he came to the property, filled out the whole application, everything we needed to do. He took care of it for that. And then it came time for managing the store. And this is why I wanted to take on my business partner too, because he had at that time 5 Subway franchises that he had bought, and he had just bought them a year previously. And when he bought them, came this amazing rock star supervisor that oversaw all the stores, took care of everything for them. And so part of the deal was that we would use her to start the liquor store. So she hired the first few employees. She put in like our cash register system. She got the security cameras. She did everything to get the store set up and hired those first few employees. One roadblock we had was that there's just not a large pool of people that have a liquor store experience. So we actually went after bartenders that had managed the bar because they were familiar with alcohol. They did the bar inventory. They ordered for the bar, things like that. And we actually found an amazing manager that we still have today. So that is my most passive business because of how we set it up. As to the one thing we both did not want to do was we did not want to work there. We also didn't want the call, oh, so-and-so can't come in, so what should we do? Can you take care of it? Can you come in? Things like that. If somebody didn't show up to work or call off, I have no idea if that happened because the manager takes care of it. But we bought that property in December 2019, and we finished renovating it by June of 2020, and then we got our liquor license in September of 2020. And that's when we opened in October. I think it was October, November 2020.
Do you want to start a liquor store?
I totally would. Like, okay, so do you still own this place?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is it from what Ashley knew going into this with an idea to fast forward to today? It sounds like you've had it open for what, coming up on 5 years?
Yeah,
Is it still a good years. Business? Like, would you do it again knowing what you know now?
100% I would do it again, because also with our business, so the liquor store is taxed differently than the rental income on that property. So we offset a lot of the other, because we have 3 other tenants in that property. So we have the liquor license pay a huge rent payment. We have the liquor store pay all the utilities, the insurance. So basically they have a triple net lease. They're paying all the repairs, things like that. So it actually really helps offset some of the liquor store income, and then passing it through to the building where we're not taxed as much on it. So having a business in that rental property has actually been just a tax advantage in general, I would say, because of being able to do that, just writing the lease so that the liquor store is responsible for all of those expenses. As far as the headaches that I thought there would be, like, that's actually less than we expected, which is great. And I think that's part of having our great manager in place. As far as how profitable it would be, there was way more startup expenses than we ever could have imagined. We did not make any money that first year of just like, we need more space. There was a little attached garage, and after about 6 months, our manager said, like, we have no more storage. We need to like renovate that and add more storage so we can have more inventory. We did that. But one thing I'm always proud of is that we don't have any, like a lot of liquor store owners will put their actual inventory on, use a line of credit or something to buy it, or, you know, finance it somehow. But we actually own all of our inventory in cash, so the liquor store has no debt on it too. So that's been a huge asset. And we've actually already been approached multiple times for people who want to come and buy it. So that's really just like our end goal of this, is to make it a sellable asset at some time.
Sure. Oh, that's so cool.
Owen, right down the street.
Okay.
There's a condemned building.
We're in.
Yeah. There's a condemned building. It's got apartments on top. It's got a garage in the back. It's got an old bar in the front.
Okay, perfect.
I have to tell you too, one of my best friends from high school actually lived in the apartment above it for a while. And it was like so funny. Her and her boyfriend would do recreational drugs sometimes. And he would get into this like mode that he had to protect the liquor store with his life. If anybody ever came and tried to break into it, he was ready to defend it.
So you conscripted him basically and put him into active service and defense. I love it.
It's amazing what mushrooms can do.
So what kind of correlation between the Buffalo Bills record and one loss record and liquor sales is there? Have you done a graph on when the spikes?
No, but is this too fresh? That would actually be very, very interesting to correlate. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I appreciate you you covering that, because I was just, you know, like everybody has their own thing, right? So when you talk about people that are in real estate and their story and how they kind of, you know, evolved over time, I thought yours was really fascinating, because you started the liquor store business. Am I right in understanding you started an insurance agency?
I did that. I started a bunch of businesses for this other investor that I was working for. So he was the one that owned the liquor store too. And when I was working for him, he wanted to start an insurance agency. So I went and got licensed, and then I started it for him. So he had the ownership of it. I didn't technically own it, but I started it. And then one thing that I really, really have realized over the years that I like and don't like is I like to start a business, but then once it's up and running, I don't want anything to do with it. And the business actually failed and he closed it down after it kind of went on. But he partnered with another insurance broker in town. And so they actually ran it together, and there was some partnership disputes and things like that. But it was very, very interesting having to set up the insurance company for sure.
Yeah. Out of all businesses I've ever done, I was an American Family insurance rep at one point in my life, and that was one of my least favorite jobs I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
I was Northwestern Mutual agent, so I sold life insurance, disability, like in you know, retirement plans and all that. But
I probably did like 5 policies like the whole time, like we were starting this up, and it was like my own some of my own properties. But then after that, I was like, I just want to referral fee.
So you were like a real estate agent. You were like a real estate agent that got their license just so they could buy their own stuff and make a commission or save some money. Yeah. What any other businesses maybe that you've been into that are real estate related or not real estate related?
Yeah. So when I was working for this investor, he had 2 dry cleaning facilities and 2 laundromats. Yeah. So there's 4 altogether. Mm-hmm. And these were like running into the ground. Like he was continuously dumping cash into them. So my previous experience was I went to school for accounting and finance. And then I started working at a CPA firm after college. And that's where I quit to go work for him. But I would go through the books and like find where, you know, there was things. And that was like my favorite part, as to like this going and digging and trying to find where there was too much money being spent or where mistakes were made. Or like I found out one of the employees was taking 3 weeks paid vacation when she was only allocated 1, but nobody was checking. There was nobody looking. And so he, over the next couple of years, he ended up shutting down and selling the buildings. And then he kept 1 laundromat. And so I worked on turning over the laundromat, and then I actually sold it at a premium to his daughter and my business partner.
No kidding. So,
yeah.
All right. You have a finance and accounting background. Obviously, you seem to be very talented at it. Otherwise, why would you get approached by business owners to help with, transitioning or turnaround? But I assume the guy that you were doing this work for and the turnaround project with the laundromat and dry cleaning facilities, he's probably an older dude, right? You said his son eventually that you ended up kind of working with on some deals.
Yeah, his son and his son-in-law.
So, okay.
I grew up with his daughter, but right now he's in his 60s, mid-60s. So this was, when he was in his late 50s.
Okay. And so you were you fairly fresh out of school?
Only lasted 6 months working at the accounting firm before I quit. And I was like, I hate this. I cannot sit at a desk all day. And so my plan was actually just to get pregnant and be a stay-at-home mom. And so I was like, I put in my 2 weeks notice. I got pregnant. I was like, this is great. And then he actually came to me and said, and it wasn't anything with accounting. It was, I need somebody to help me be organized. And that was the conversation. And he's like, you can work from home, work on your schedule. I'll also provide you health insurance, which my husband at the time, he was a dairy farmer. So having health insurance since he was self-employed was a big deal too. So I worked from home. It was part-time. I could make my own hours. And what it ultimately ended up being as to be organized was managing a 40-unit apartment complex with no idea how to be a property manager.
Quote-unquote, be organized.
Yeah. And it was, in the complex was a small office with a little bathroom. There was no windows, no air conditioning. And there was a desk in there and a bunch of boxes. The boxes had the lease agreements in it. And then in the drawer was just a whole bunch of keys. Over the course of 2 years, I developed an actual property management company to oversee this. And then he bought another 40 units. And then I found out about property management software and, started automating things, everything like that. But that's how I kind of got into real estate, was that property management experience I got from that.
Okay. This is fascinating. I want to dig into this a little bit more if that's okay. I'm assuming you were probably 22, 23-ish when you graduated. You, almost 60-year-old guy is like, hey, you're in accounting and finance. I don't have my shit together at all. Can you help me a little bit? And you came in, you're like, what am I doing, man? What are you doing? And then you start kind of putting some things into place to make the business run more smoothly. Any advice you might give to somebody that I'm just playing this in my mind where I'm the age I am, which is 49, and I'm hiring somebody that's right out of college that I'm like, God, help me, because my business is, I have all this stuff, but I don't know how to run it and I'm not paying attention to it. And I just need somebody to curate this and have it make sense. And for an old guy like me, how do you go about working with somebody that there's a generational gap and you have maybe a little bit of imposter syndrome coming out of school? Just maybe explore that topic a little bit on how can you go about when you don't really have your feet under you yet from a career perspective. And you know some things that are useful to somebody that doesn't have their shit together.
Well, I think part of the difference is too, was that I grew up right next door to him. So the fact that he knew me throughout my whole childhood, I went on family vacations with them to their lake house, things like that. I think that definitely made a difference, that we already kind of knew each other in that almost a daughter father kind of way, where it wasn't just meeting and just working together. So I will definitely say that I was probably not the right person for any of those jobs to begin with, because it probably took me a lot longer to figure it out, just not doing any of that before. I remember my first mistake was I paid $10,000. He wanted me to pay $10,000 off of a loan, and I put it towards the wrong loan. And there's no getting that money back to change it to the other one. But one thing was he was always so understanding. And I think this was actually a deficit to him, is that he was never really confrontational about things, as if I was honest and upfront of the mistakes that I made or what happened or what was going on. He always was understanding of that, okay, what do we do to fix it? And let's move on. So I think that was like a big thing, was that he knew that I was loyal to him and that he could trust me. So building that kind of rapport was a big thing, because I wasn't afraid to tell him I made a mistake. I mean, I hate him being disappointed in me. So yeah, that was like really, really hard. But I think he knew that I was trustworthy and I was loyal, and that was a huge thing. But as far as the generational gap, I don't have any advice onto that per se, because I feel like we already knew each other so well that it didn't seem like we had to really make some kind of relationship connection to work together well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think it's interesting to explore the idea of there's skills and trust, and one can outweigh the other, mm-hmm. right? And when you're going about trying to build a business or hire somebody for a key position, there's the trust factor. And if you, like, let's say you know, like, and trust somebody like you, but you don't necessarily have the skills or the experience that I'm looking for.
I always take the trust.
Yeah. You have to, though, if you're going to do that, you have to be willing to invest the time and the training to enable someone to succeed in a role and give them enough rope, you know, not to necessarily to hang themselves, but give them enough rope to make mistakes. And if you do trust them and they prove trustworthy, they are going to be the type of person that's going to come to you and say, "Hey, I messed this up. Here's what I did. Here's why I did it. But this didn't work out how we thought. What do you think?" I think that's just an interesting dynamic, because, like, if you're going out right now and let's say you grow your business to a point where it's not like just you wearing all the hats and you have to hire like a person and they have to do like your stuff and really handle it. But let's say you grow it to a medium size or a small to medium sized business. It comes to that point, because it's a trust versus skills thing. Like, you can't hire somebody with their resume. You're not hiring off of trust. You're hiring off of their experience and skills. So I just think that's an interesting, like, dynamic of that. And you run into that a lot with family owned businesses too, where it's, you know, the son or the daughter or both work in the business, or multiple children do. And then it's like the whole, you know, family hierarchy. And it's tough to, like, kind of break into that as an outsider. And there's always that weird dynamic of the family in it. I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I just think it's an interesting topic to explore. When you're building trust with somebody, can trump the lack of skills that you have, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think, you know, I did help him make a lot of money over the years, and he definitely saw that. And yes, there was lots of mistakes along the way. But, like, right now, when I log in to look at my personal bank account and, like, my dashboard and my kids' savings account, there's also his personal checking account on there, because he still has me linked to all this stuff. And we still work on, I still help him with money management, doing all these different things with, you know, building his personal financial statement, things like that. And now my property management company manages his properties for him. So, like, there's still, even though I'm not directly working for him anymore, there's still, like, I'm still so loyal. I just can't be like, "No, you're on your own." And so I think there's definitely, like, that value there is if you do find someone loyal and trustworthy. But I look at my maintenance person too. So my maintenance person is actually one of my business partners, and he does, this is his first time doing maintenance for property management. He worked in construction for a long time, but as far as having to do, like, update the work notes, you know, go through the maintenance requests, like, do all of the software documentation that goes along with that, he makes lots of mistakes with that. So what we did to kind of balance that out is I trust him so much with everything that he can make a lot of the decisions on his own. The part that he falls on is the actual documentation and kind of being the manager part as to all of the software things. So he has a virtual assistant that, you know, she's in the Philippines and we trust her, but I don't really know her, but she is so skilled and detail oriented that she picks up the slack where he kind of lacks. So for really inexpensive a price that, you know, what we pay her to fill that void that he doesn't actually, you know, do well or successfully.
Now, I heard you say you hired a kick-ass manager for the liquor store, right? So they have made being more passive a lot easier for you because they are trustworthy. And you just said you basically hired a contractor that had no maintenance experience, quote unquote, but he is into that role now. And because you trust him, would it be fair to say that your approach to building a business or businesses is trust, but verify and train, where like, as opposed to just hiring off of skills?
Yeah. And I have definitely struggled with hiring people and I've learned my lesson. So when I first was working for that other investor, I built out a property management company because he only had it, like he had auto dealerships and he had commercial buildings. He had all these different buildings that he wanted me to do stuff for. So I said, let's just build out a property management company that can take care of all of these things. So then we're not like, oh, Ashley, you spent 6 hours working on this property. We need to allocate, you know, these funds to here. So I built that out for him where it oversaw everything. We had maintenance people, we had things coming in. The problem was I put so much work on myself because I could never hire and find the right people. And I would try and then I would just like, I'd fire them and I'd give up. And it was really my lacking was I was not properly training them. I was not a good leader at all. And so I created that property management company. Then I had another one for myself, for my properties, which I was doing everything for. I literally was at the point of just ripping my hair out. And so I ended up, especially when I got signed with Bigger Pockets to do their podcast, I'm like, this is going to be too much. So I hired a third party property management company to take my properties. And I told the other investor, I said, this is what I'm doing. I can't manage your properties anymore. Do you want to hire them? He's like, whatever you want to do is fine with me. So we hired them and we had them for 3 years and it was the worst experience of my life. And so now, last May, so almost a year now, I created another property management company, but I used all of the things that I learned from that first experience to do it the right way. So I probably spend maybe 5 hours a week actually on the property management company. I have two virtual assistants, a full-time maintenance manager, and then a part-time maintenance person. And it is so much better. And everyone is making more money. Everything is more efficient. There was just so many headaches with the third-party property management company. They just don't care about your property. They're not going to look at a water bill and be like, oh, you know what? The water usage is actually up. Maybe there is a toilet leak. So just being able to train everybody as to like, not only be a property manager, but also be an asset manager too, I guess. So just learning from my past mistakes and doing it the way that I want so that I'm not crying at night and ripping my hair out.
Every time I'm working with a new potential investor, and we were talking about this a little bit earlier, and they're like, hey, what business should I get into to start learning the industry? And I'm like, if you want to get in any industry, learn to get into property management. That's the fastest course to becoming a investor, in my opinion. What do you guys think?
Yeah. Ted and I, we thought this was an interesting topic to explore of like, if you were, you know, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, but I know you're obviously the host of the Bigger Pockets rookie podcast, right?
Yes.
And it's interesting to see the path that people take that end up in real estate investing. And it's never the same, although there's some similarities along the way. But we were kind of exploring the idea of like, if you were going to start all the way over and try to learn the ropes instead of going like, well, maybe not instead of going to college and, you know, getting an accounting and finance degree, but what do you think is the right job for somebody that wants to really kick ass as a real estate investor? And maybe it's not a job, maybe it's jobs, but like, what do you think is the right approach there? Is it property management company that you work for? Is it working in construction? Is it working for an investor? Like, what does that look like if you had to give back, you know, Ashley advice that was 18 years old and about ready to, you know, figure out if she's going to school or not?
Yeah. I'll touch on the college piece there, if you don't mind. Yeah. I think that having an accounting background definitely helped me. But I also think there's a lot of other, you know, skill sets or jobs that you can actually do that will help you in real estate, like project management. Like, who doesn't want somebody that can run their rehabs, things like that. So I'm not saying don't go to college, but my six-year-old, he keeps announcing to everybody that he's not going to college. He's not going to get a job. He's just going to be a pro snowboarder and buy houses and rent them out. So I like actually feel that's really great. Proud. I'm yeah, like, that's yes, all, that, let's that is do a mic this. Drop. Okay. Yeah. Like, I feel like old me before real estate would be like, no, that is, you need to set yourself up for success. But like, it's crazy how my mind has shifted. It's like, you are so smart. Yes, let's plan this out. Let's do this for you. But so he's dead set on that. But I think there's definitely college degrees that, you know, can assist you. But I think as far as me being an accountant, it really helped me in the beginning, you know, reading financial statements, being able to do that. But you can easily outsource bookkeeping. Like, that's one of the first things most people actually outsource anyways. And then most people, you know, once you're buying rental properties, you're usually not preparing your own tax return if you even were, you know, with just a W-2 job. So as far as going into like a job to start, I agree. I think property management is a great way because you can get involved in so many different aspects of the property. As you could, you know, take the maintenance calls, you could do the leasing. And I think the really big advantage of getting into property management is that there's some way that you could actually do this part-time while still maintaining your job that you have now. So it's not a 100, you know, an 80 degree shift into something different, but you can, you know, do maintenance requests. If you have some handy skills, you could just say, hey, I'm available nights, I'm available weekends to a property management company, and I can do maintenance requests. You could do leasing and offer to be the leasing agent that shows properties on Sundays. So there's a lot of different things there. But ultimately, I think the best is if you can work for an actual investor. So I started working for him in 2013, and then I bought my first property in 2014. And I made, just in that year, I made a lot of connections with loan officers and also attorneys. And when it was time for me to buy my first property, I already had a team built just because I was exposed to this investor's team. And it was no problem getting set up with the loan officer and getting funding because I was the one that he worked with directly for the other investor when doing all of his loans. And I was super timely in getting him everything he needed. I always responded right away. And he like really enjoyed working with me because usually it was with the actual investor who, you know, doesn't know where anything is and things like that. And he had also seen how I was like changing things with the properties and things like that. So if you're able to get in with somebody's team, I think can be a huge advantage too.
Yeah, great tip. And now I don't want to gloss over the fact here that you live in upstate New York, right? You're Buffalo, is that correct?
Yeah, technically Western New York. If anyone from Western New York is listening, they would be
my
upset
apology. I didn't correct you. Now, you mentioned you have a dairy farm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What does that look like? So you and your husband, obviously, now I don't want to assume this, but does he run the dairy farm and you are doing everything that you had just talked about?
Yeah. So we're separated now. We've been separated 3-4 years, but okay. I mean, technically we're still married because we just don't tax benefits being married still and health insurance, but we have houses that are super close to each other. So co-parenting with the kids, everything works great, but he has two farms that he runs. And then I do all of the real estate stuff. And so we have our own separate things. Like my name's not on any of the farm stuff and his name isn't on any of the real estate stuff. I think there's still a couple of like loans on rental properties that he's on, maybe like that, but everything's been transferred into a single LLC. But yeah, everything is pretty much separate between us. The only thing that we own together is our primary residence, whereas like the kids' home base that we still share.
Yeah. Yes. Now on that topic, so you have three children, is that correct?
Yep. Three boys.
Okay. So you've thrown out a lot of information here about stuff that you've done with real estate investing and different multiple businesses. You've started. It's different having a business or starting a business because there's so much pre-work into planning. Like, you know, I'm going to open a liquor store. Do I like what? Who's a liquor licensed broker? Like, I didn't even know that was a thing until you just told me that a little bit ago. But how do you go about approaching balancing like being a good mom and being a good steward of your properties that are your own and then also those that you manage for others? Like, how do you approach just balancing all of your stuff and keeping sane along the way?
Yeah, so I struggled with that for a long time. I got a lot of guilt from people around me. Like, my mom, I love her to death, but she was very like, you're missing out on your kids' childhood. They're only young ones. And it was really hard for me. And I worked a ton. Like, the kids would be playing on the floor and I would be working on my computer and I would just be like hustling and grinding and saying, Mom, can you babysit? I have to go look at this property, doing all these things. And I am so thankful that I did that because everybody says your kids are only young ones. Well, they're only 10 months. They're only 15 months. They're only 18 months. And right now I'm in a position where I still work. I still have to sometimes say to my kids, like, I have to get work done and then we can go do that, whatever it may be. But I am a lot more conscious of separating the two because there was a long time where I tried to do both and my work didn't get the full attention and the kids didn't get the full attention. And it made things so much worse because there was that aspect of like, oh, I get to work from home. I shouldn't send my kids to my mom's house to be babysat. They should be home. Like, I'm fortunate to have that. But I wasn't being intentional with my time with them and it wasn't quality time. So I've really learned that instead of spending 8 hours with them where it's taking me longer to get my work done because I'm throwing snacks at them, doing whatever, it is better to work for 4 hours, get that work done. And then the next 4 hours have intentional time. And honestly, it's probably like 6 and 2 or whatever, you know, depending on the day, but making sure that it's more intentional and focused and having that quality time is so much better, I think, than being with them 100% of the time. And so I travel a lot to do events. And when I'm on the airplane, I'm working. I'm trying to get as much work as I can while I'm traveling. But now I've gotten to the position where, you know, my two youngest ones, they're 5 and 6 or 6 and 7. And they have been traveling with me now where they will go to a conference. They will sit there. They will listen. Within the last year, they've been going up on stage with me. So like if I MC an event, they come up. My young son, Colt, he likes to do all the giveaways. So at any conference I go to, he'll give stuff out and, you know, ask questions. And so I'm doing an event in March that he's coming with me to. And I just have like a 30-minute speaking slot or whatever. And then the next day, it's close to his birthday. So the next day we're going to a super nice hotel with water slides and things like that. So we're trying to, like, you know, do the one day of a little bit of work and then the next day go and have fun and hang out for his birthday. But I think that's definitely helped a lot that I can, first of all, afford to have them travel with me. You know, airfare is not always the cheapest.
Yeah,
and then
no kidding.
Also that they are engaging and they're listening and they're learning. So my 6-year-old at the last conference he went to, it was actually for Bigger Pockets. And it was a podcast host retreat where for 2 days we sat in sessions talking about how to do better with the podcast, all these different things. And then we went snowboarding and that's the reason why he wanted to come because we were going snowboarding. But at night he would tell me all these little things that he picked up and he was listening to in the room and things like that. And it was really interesting to seeing what they're developing. But even at 6 years old, he'll go up, someone will say, hi, Remington. And he'll be like, hi, how are you? Like, he's becoming very mature in how social he is too. I've definitely noticed. So I think that has been a big difference as to just incorporating them into my life and like making it fun for them. Like my son Colt, when he does giveaways at events, like, he's done AJ Osborne's self-storage event. Like, this last year was his 3rd year doing it. And everybody's chanting, "We want Colt, we want Colt," you know, and they make name tags for him. Like he's like part of the whole thing and he just loves it. And it, I don't ever want my kids to feel stage fright or to have that public speaking fear that so many people I feel like develop. I want them to always be comfortable and be social and learn that networking is a huge benefit. Kind of rambled on there, but it's something I'm super passionate about and excited
about. I'm going to see folks. My kids are 6 and 10, and we hold our monthly local RIA events here. And we have probably about 125 people in the room usually. But the kids will always come up, and I'm always like, hey, if I'm presenting and it's time for you to leave, because they leave and it's time for bed.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can come up to the front and give me hugs and say hi to everybody. So the kids will walk past. And I can imagine that they walk through the whole entire room and then come up to the mic and then say hi and then say bye, Dad.
Yeah.
And so it's those little things to just trying to get them, you know, used to that. But it, you know, you mentioned one thing about that kind of that work time balancing with the family time. And I remember just last night I was taking my daughter to basketball and that's my workspace. So, you know, I got the internet in the truck, you know, I set my laptop and I get a lot of work done.
Yeah.
And then Skyler comes out. She goes like, "Daddy, are you really sad that this is my last practice because you won't have your work time?" And I'm like, yes, just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I really like about what you said though is you're basically describing time blocking without labeling it, and I like the fact that you're cognizant of the kids are so impacted by what we do in little ways, and you mentioned your son. Like he picked up little tidbits kind of like along the way during the conference, and you just never know what they're going to latch onto. And I think you have to be mindful all the time about being a good parent is something that there's a responsibility and there's also guilt along the way with that, because especially when you're an entrepreneur, you don't have set hours, and it's sometimes stuff comes up that you have to handle, and it's just how it is. But I think it goes a long way if you set expectations with kids and like, hey, just so you know, like this is our thing and I want to spend time with you on this, but I have to do this in order to get to that. And I think that there's a disconnect sometimes with people that, you know, because there's the trap of becoming an entrepreneur. And then what's the saying? It's like entrepreneurs will avoid a 40-hour work, or they like don't want to do a 40-hour work week because they want to do an 80-hour work week. Like, you don't want somebody else telling you what to do for 40 hours.
You don't want the 80 hours.
Yeah. Well, do it. You're willing to work 80 hours under your own direction to avoid working 40 hours for somebody else is kind of the thing, right? I mean, it's like zone defense when you're raising multiple kids that need attention. And each kid needs a different type of attention. Like, some are... You know, it's the whole five love language approach to it. You have to figure out kind of like what's their jam. And you need time with all of them, right? That's more important than anything, I think. But it's quality time. You mentioned not dividing your attention between a screen, and you're trying to be omnipresent with your work and your family life. And it's just not possible. So you can kind of coexist with that whole thing where you're like paying attention to your work and like, oh, I have an offer coming in. So, but yes, I'm also watching Abbott Elementary or whatever you have going on. You know what I mean? It's just like, I think it's better to like remove yourself from the equation of that situation rather than have them think it's okay for Dad to be present, but not present. Where it's like, yeah, Dad was there. And then like your kids will ask you like, oh, what'd you think of that? Or they're laughing at something and they're trying to talk to you and relate. And you're like, oh man, I missed that. What's up? And then they repeat, you know what I mean? Like I hate that about myself sometimes and I'm not perfect about it either, but I love that I think it's a thing where if you recognize that and you work on it, it's progress over perfection as a parent, and you're your own worst critic all the time, unless you have, you know, your mom. Like telling you like, hey, you know, your mom or dad is always going to let you know how you're doing overall. Right, they're always your check-in.
Maybe my wife's parents, but not my parents.
I love that, and you know, kudos to you for managing through you know, separation. I didn't know that obviously, but that's not an easy thing, I would imagine. So especially having three children and trying to, you know, work through the logistical challenges of it. But, you know, sounds like you guys are doing the best you can out of the situation.
It's honestly been easier than I expected. And my 10-year-old, which I didn't mention him at any of the conferences because he is farm boy to a T. He will not leave the farm. He does not want to travel anywhere. He went on a road trip to Florida with me and a cruise 2 years ago. And that's just like, that was the last couple times he traveled. And he just wants to be home with a dad on the farm. So it's funny, like all three boys are very different. So he is like a motorhead. Went to Ohio the other day to this tractor store. They got all these different tractor parts and they're rebuilding a motor. And he's telling me what each wire is for and everything like that. Then my second one, just athletic to a T, you know, football, basketball, whatever sport he does, he's really good at it. My third one trips over everything, is the clumsiest person you could see, but he's more of like X game stuff. Like he's a phenomenal snowboarder. He's better than his brothers. And, you know, he does scootering and biking and different things like that. So it's so funny how they each have their own thing. So.
Isn't that crazy? Like they're raised by exactly the same parents and like you would hope a fairly similar ways.
Yeah.
And they're so different. Like personality, like will trump your parenting style no matter what over time. Yeah. Cause I have two daughters and they're 15 and 12 and they could not be more different personality wise.
Yeah.
And my boy and girl, I mean, they're 10 and 6, but they are very similar in sports. They both are completely obsessed with sports. But my son, if we lived on the farm, he would be the farm boy because he does not like to leave the house. He's like, ooh, do we really got to go that far for a family vacation? And then my daughter's like, I want to see the ocean. I want to see everything. So that's the only difference that we really get. But personality-wise, they're almost exactly the same. So it's kind of odd.
Huh. Yeah, that's different. So Ashley, can you maybe describe what your business / portfolio looks like right now? And maybe what your plans are moving forward here with the stuff you have going on.
Sure. I have a little over, it's probably like 36, 37 units right now. They're all, except for five of them, are long-term buy and hold, just rentals. They range from a single family to a six unit. And then I have my short-term rentals. And then I also have two apartments that I rent and do Airbnb arbitrage with them too. So, and then I flipped two houses and then I'm hopefully getting my next flip under contract today. And then I have six units under contract right now.
Are your short terms all in town or are they around the country?
No, everything I have is right in Buffalo. I did do one flip in Seattle once. And other than that, everything has been right outside of Buffalo.
Literally the furthest possible place in the United States that you could get without being Alaska. Right. Yeah. Furthest away from you. That's funny. So it sounds like over time now you've assembled a portfolio of residential and commercial assets. Now, it doesn't sound like, based on what you just said, that you've sold a lot. So you haven't transacted a ton of real estate, but you have purchased and held a lot of it. Is that fair to say?
Actually, no. I probably sold like six or seven properties throughout that time. Yeah.
Okay. Let's maybe could you talk about why you decided to sell them? And did you go into each purchase with the intent on buying and selling it? Or was that a byproduct of a situation that came up?
Okay. Yeah, sure. So I started buying in 2014 and it was just slow, like buying duplexes here and there. And I had one business partner at that point. And then I learned about Bigger Pockets and I was like, oh my gosh, you can actually do all these creative financing things, seller financing, all this stuff. And I was like, I can buy more stuff now. And so my first purchase after finding Bigger Pockets was a 12 unit portfolio from another investor. And he's the one I actually ended up buying the liquor store building from. But I just started like, wow, I just like figuring out all the these ways to find deals, to purchase them. And I, at one point, it must have been like 2018, maybe, I was like, okay, I need to like pause. I have just brought on all these properties, bought on so much. I'm managing all of them. I have no systems and processes in place. I feel like I am treading water. My bookkeeping's getting behind. And I felt like we were leveraged, just way more leveraged than I would have wanted to be. And it was probably 80% leveraged on the portfolio. And I wanted to be more at 70. And so we ended up selling one property that we had owned in cash. And we used that cash to pay off another property. And now it went down tremendous as to how much we were leveraged. And that just like taking those 2 units off of our plate, adding up, you know, adding more cash flow because now our debt is lower. But we kind of did that just to like take a breather. And then we paused a little bit, started working on, okay, when we get new properties, what should we be doing better? You know, like creating an acquisition checklist and things like that. So that was why I sold the first property was we only held it for 1 year. We cash flowed on it while we held it. And then we sold it for 10 grand more than we bought it for the following year. So it was great. Like we made some money on it. And after that, I sold most of my properties in 2021 when the market was hot and I could get rid of those dumpy $20,000 duplexes I bought that no matter how much money I dumped into them, there always was another problem. There was always a headache tenant. And I sold those for like most of them I bought for $20,000 to $30,000. I sold them all for like $60,000 to $80,000. So it was amazing. But got rid of those, kind of cleared out my portfolio at that time when I sold those other ones.
Okay. How did you get on the Bigger Pockets radar? Is I'm sure a question you've been asked a million times, but I don't want to skip over this because you're in Buffalo, New York. It's not Manhattan. You have assembled an impressive portfolio. You've done some really cool stuff with business. What happened to how are you the Bigger Pockets rookie podcast host? You have, and we haven't mentioned this yet, you're a published author. Talk about maybe that. Like how did you like put yourself out there and how did you leverage that into you know, a book deal? And, you know, let's explore the persona now of Ashley Care.
Yeah. So I started out stalking Brandon Turner on Instagram. I created an Instagram account just about my real estate investing. Actually, it started off in my debt payoff journey is what it started out to be. I talked about how I bought rental properties. I used the cash flow from that to pay off my debt. And now I was debt free. I had paid off student loans. I had paid off farm equipment and also a HELOC that had been on our primary residence. And then I started sharing about rental property investing and things. And my goal was to be a guest on the Bigger Pockets podcast. That's what I wanted out of this Instagram account. So I would tag Brandon Turner and everything. And once in a while, he would, you know, reshare it in my story. I would tag Bigger Pockets and everything. I would comment on their posts, things like that. And finally, one day I get a DM and it's from somebody I don't know. And he's like, hey, I'm the producer for the Bigger Pockets podcast. I've been seeing you all over Instagram. We would love to, you know, talk to you about maybe being on the podcast. So I was like, literally like freaking out, shaking, didn't know what to do. So I was like, yes, that would be amazing. So we get on a call like the next day, he's talking to me, asking me about myself. He's like, yes, this would be great. I'd really like to have you on. And afterwards he sends me an email with like some dates. So I email him. Like a couple weeks go by, there's never like a confirmation, anything. I go and look at his Instagram. He is getting married. It's like literally his wedding day when I'm looking at his Instagram. And so then he goes on his honeymoon. And so it's like a month has gone by now. And so I wait until I see on Instagram, he's not on his honeymoon anymore. And I send a follow-up email. And he was just like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Like I got married. I had my honeymoon. Like,
I'm sorry I got married.
Yeah. Let's get you on next week or whatever. And so I recorded, and then this was, I think it was released in like September 2019, my actual episode. And then at the Bigger Pockets conference, that was the next month when they did like their first conference since they had done one in like 2015 or something.
Was that the Tennessee?
And it was like perfect timing because a lot of people knew who I was from listening to the podcast. And, you know, so I made a lot of connections just from having myself on that episode. And then Bigger Pockets announced they wanted to do another podcast, submit an application with your idea of what the topic should be or whatever. And I submitted building generational wealth for your kids. Well, I got a call from the producer and he said, "Hey, Ashley, I received your application." He's like, "Fortunately, we think that idea is like good for one show, not really like a whole series, but we would love to have you audition to be a host." And so he paired me up with my first partner, Felipe Mejia, and we went through like an interview round where we actually found out on December 16th, which was my mom's birthday. I missed the phone call because we were singing happy birthday to my mom.
Oh my God. And so
I ran upstairs into her bedroom afterwards and I called back and he's like, "Hi, we want to let you know that," because they narrowed it down to three. So we knew we were in the top three of the couples. And he's like, "I want you to know that we selected you, you were picked." And I remember getting on the phone and I was like screaming and my mom came running up, "What's wrong?" But yeah, so, and then after that, it just, Bigger Pockets is really great because when you are part of their community, they're like, "Write blog posts, like let's write a book, let's do all these different things," because it's mutually beneficial having that relationship and developing things. So that's how the book deals kind of came with it.
Felipe was randomly in Omaha last year and was at one of the local meetup.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, "I know you from somewhere." he's like, "I'm in town coaching somebody." And then he couldn't get an Uber. And I ended up giving him a ride to his Airbnb. Okay. And then he's like, "Man, I really want to get on that podcast." And I still never hit him back to do that. But like, I got to do that.
That's funny. Give a plug for your book. You wrote it. When was the time frame on this?
So I wrote the book. I started writing it a year and a half before it was published, and it just came out December of 2022.
The title is 90 Days to Your First Real Estate Investment. Is that right?
Yeah. So Real Estate Rookie.
Real Estate Rookie. Okay. And now, why did you decide, or did you have much of a choice on it, on hosting the Real Estate Rookie podcast? You obviously, I mean, this has been, I feel like, there's, when you get people on a podcast, there's people that, what do you got there?
I'm showing her. I listened to the book.
Okay.
Oh,
you set this up. I couldn't see
you. You were holding it off to the side. I thought there was like somebody in the room. You were like,
"Oh my God."
No, he's just a brown noser. You see, he wanted to show that he's read your book.
I finished it a couple days. Well, I listened to it a couple weeks ago.
Thank you.
But when did you start? You said you started it and then a year and a half later it got released. Is that normal? Is that a thing with publishing a book?
I mean, not for Brandon Turner and David Green. I mean, right. They're knocking out books every 3 months. Goes,
but when we met up with him, he's like, "Yeah, I just go to the coffee shop and I just create the whole outline and and I won't leave until the outline's done." I'm like, "Dude, seriously?"
Yeah, I actually, before the books, I actually had a passion project with Bigger Pockets that I wanted to teach some kind of like boot camp class, which has come to fruition, but they didn't have any kind of program for like any kind of coaching. And everybody else was offering all these coaching, all these courses, things like that. So I introduced to Bigger Pockets, I want to teach a class, almost like you go to the site Masterclass and you can sign up. I want to learn about this and you watch the videos and you take the class, whatever. I want to do something like that. So I built out this whole bootcamp class and they came up with the name bootcamp and that's what it's called now. But I just wanted to take like the steps of, here's how to get your first deal. This is the order you have to do it. There is so much information online that you could 100% learn to do this for free. You don't have to pay to learn. A lot of people have. But if you don't have the time or you have analysis paralysis and you've just been stuck and haven't taken action, I'm going to take each step, walk you through it. So I wrote out this whole course outline. I used Google Classroom, which teachers use, and I built out a classroom. I had my cousin, who's a teacher, help me do that. And I had homework assignments, and I did live Zoom calls. And so we started with just 100 people, just did a beta test. And basically, I used that outline to write the book. So the book is based off of that boot camp class. And now the boot camp, there's, you know, last year, our January one always does the best. And we had over 800 people that signed up for it. So we do three a year now. And then there's other ones that other people come on and host. Like there's a multifamily one, a short-term rental one. There was a house hacking one. There's been a bunch of different ones that they offer every so often. And so that just taking that course outline was really my starting point for the book as to like, I can take this and I can write it in a book as to what you need. You're not going to get the live Zoom sessions with me, be able to ask questions. You're not going to get the community of meeting like-minded people, but I can at least give you the content at a more affordable price.
Yeah, I love that. When you're looking ahead here, what do you see in the future or near future for your investing or business acquisitions, or like what's next for you? Is it hold what you have, manage it well, or are you in growth mode still? Like maybe give us a snapshot in kind of the world of Ashley right now.
Yeah. So I really want to keep building. I spent the last year. So I actually 2 years ago, I went chasing campgrounds and I thought was like, that's my next big thing I wanted to do. I did a ton of research. I put offers in. I got a couple under contract that fell through. And I've decided like, that's not actually what I want. And so I've pivoted again back. And so last year I did cabins, where I bought cabins, renovated them, and we turned them into Airbnbs. I'm sitting in one right now and I actually use it as my office and I stay here a lot. It's turned out super nice. And one day maybe I'll rent it out. So we take cabins and we make them super modern and nice and rent them out. So that's what we did last year. And short-term rental operations isn't like my bread and butter. So that's just like fun for me. And, you know, it makes great money, but it's also more intensive and more involvement than long-term rentals for me, because I have just that system down pat where my property management team is so great. So trying to build that back up as far as doing, small multifamily deals. So I have a 5-unit under contract right now. I have, hopefully today, a single family that I'm actually going to flip, and it will be my first intentional flip in Buffalo. I did flip one other house before, and it was supposed to be a rental. And then when we finished it, my agent came to look at it and she's like, no, I can sell it for this. So let's just sell it. And we did. And she was right. We sold it for a lot of money. And so I'm going to do a couple flips this year too, and then build my rental portfolio back up.
So awesome. Most of my portfolio is all short-term, midterms. And, and we interviewed, Mark Simpson, got to know him quite a bit on that last BP conference. Mm-hmm. And so we did interview with him and was convinced I needed to do his program. So I'm waiting for I'm waiting for my Boostly site to get done right now.
Yeah.
So I can put all my short terms on it. So I'll have to let you know how that goes and if it simplifies life, which I'm hoping it does.
Yeah. So we're just on Airbnb right now. We use Hostfully. So we have the option to set up or through them to do a direct booking website. But what I did for my short-term rentals, which has really helped a lot, and this kind of ties back to the piece of what's a great job for somebody to do if they want to get into real estate, is co-hosting and managing someone else's Airbnb. So I have a friend that has, she has like 4 rentals now, and she's a physical therapist, and she wants to get more into real estate and eventually leave her PT job. So I hired her as my short-term rental manager. So she coordinates the cleaners. She coordinates the booking. She does all the guest communication, and she's paid 5%. So whatever we make off, she gets 5% of the bookings, and she takes care of everything. So that is just, she's getting experience in short-term rentals. She doesn't have any of her own yet, but she would like to, but she just picked up another client per se. And she's like, I already have this experience. And so she has someone else now that she's managing for too. And it's kind of a great way for her to build some extra money to save to invest some more. But I think she would agree that this is a great way for someone else to get started too in real estate and get some experience.
See, that's what Owen needs to find, because this guy right here has a badass short term here in town, which is like the top level of a building with its private elevator.
Yeah, it's, I have a penthouse unit, and it's like I'm the worst manager in the world. Seriously, like
tell her what you did.
Okay, I talked about this last episode. What I was trying to do was basically I didn't want to use VRBO anymore as a source. I was just going to go with Airbnb and see what that brought me. And I thought I disconnected the calendar, and I actually didn't. What I really did was I blocked off the calendar for 2 months, and I had so much other crap going on that I just was not paying attention to it. And I was like, oh, well, it's my first year in Nebraska. Like, I'm in Omaha, Nebraska. Maybe we just don't get bookings during the wintertime or whatever. I've got like no bookings in 2 months. And I decided to pay attention to it. And I was just like, what is going on here? And I looked and I was like, oh my God, these are all blocked off. Like all of them.
Rookie mistake.
Yeah, totally. And then I went and I was like, oh, you just have to like click this button where it says disconnect calendar. Yeah.
It might only cost
then I got, 10 or like, 20 grand. Actually, this is funny. So today after the, and I'm managing this myself still, obviously very poorly. But this is funny because today is my first booking since I activated the calendar again. So I have to go after this, which mine is like 10 blocks from here. So I have to go like right down the street, and I have to go like drop off like toilet paper and napkins and stuff like this, because I haven't been there in like 2 months. You know what I mean? Like, I don't even know what's missing, but I know my cleaning person was like, hey, we need to restock X, Y, and Z.
And dust. I'm just like, probably need dust.
Oh yeah. Yes, for sure. Yeah.
So there's another thing too, is you give your manager an Amazon account, and she can order those supplies and ship it right to your cleaner. And then when your cleaner goes there, your cleaner just takes it.
See, I need somebody like you in my life is the point of this whole thing. Like, this is the only reason you're on the podcast, is just for me. So I just wanted to absorb all of your knowledge, but that's a great tip. And like, I love all the creative different avenues you're pursuing with this. And it all ties into generating income, managing your stuff successfully, and being able to, you know, provide, right? Like, and you have growth plans out of this, but you're also supporting a family as, you know, like you are in upstate New York. And it's not like we live in the Midwest, right? So Ted and I live in Omaha, Nebraska, and it's not, you know, I would say we have like just under 1 million population for the MSA. So it's not like a gigantic metropolis area, and the prices are, I think, similar to upstate New York as far as like price points go on homes, maybe with some variations, but yeah, it's like, you know, I think a lot of people have the misconception that you can just jump into rental properties and coast, like it's just passive income and you're going to exceed your former job and like you're all good. And that's not the case.
That's what my wife thinks.
Yeah, you have to create opportunities, and you have to monetize some of them. You can't just put it all on autopilot, and it's not like that. You have to make moves that generate income that allow you to pay for stuff in your life and your family and all that. And I just love all the stuff you're doing. You're a total hustler, and like, you've leveraged your experience in what you're doing into a bigger platform, and has led to a lot of new opportunities. This episode's Failing Forward is brought to you by JM Real Estate Capital. One thing we haven't really talked about, is because it sounds like you've just been kicking ass all along the way here, is we want to maybe talk about something that hasn't gone according to plan, which we have a section called
Failing Forward,
where you ran into a situation, didn't go like you would have hoped, and maybe learned some lessons along the way. You have anything like that that maybe exists in your past?
Yeah, definitely. And this was during my campground phase. Some kids go through a goth phase, and mine was a campground phase. So
did you have a goth phase? We need to know.
No, I didn't. It was, okay. Yeah.
What was your phase then?
You know what? I feel like I've gone through like every other phase, like the snowboarder phase, you know, the punk rock girl. I guess that punk rock, I guess, could be close to goth. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
I had an alternative stage where I had hair down to here, and you know.
Oh yeah.
Ew. I've never had hair longer than that, as you can tell. I had a mini mullet for a while.
What was those are
back now.
I know, it's gross.
You were like a jock phase. You went through a jock.
Yeah,
phase.
I was an athlete, so yeah. I was kind of preppy athlete.
That was what I was majority of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, I did have a studded belt, but I wore snowboarding.
Studded belt with spikes.
So, yeah, during my campground phase, I was like, I want to do this. I signed my partner up to take like a campground course because I don't have the attention span to actually sit through a course. So I was like, we're going to learn everything about this. And I was like, my family went camping a lot when I was younger. But, you know, I know what to do for camping. I could run a campground. And we looked at two campgrounds. One was an older couple. They just, the wife was ready to walk away. The husband really wasn't. And so we started negotiating with them a little bit. Then we also found this place called Bear Mountain Creek. And it was over 700 acres. It had a huge, huge pond, almost like a lake. And then it had 80 RV hookups and like 16 cabins on it. I think it had an in-ground pool. It had a huge like venue space for a wedding. It had a bar and restaurant, and the bank went to foreclose on it. And also the county went had it after it for back taxes. So it went up for tax auction. The bank ended up buying it because it wasn't selling for enough that they would get any money from it from like the next highest bidder. So they went in and they just bought it back. So the bank owned it. So they were originally asking, I think like $3 million maybe, and which was a lot for me. Like my biggest deal at, from that point was like $300,000 maybe. So looking at this as like, okay, can we do this? And we got so many ideas of ways to generate income off this property. It had like a side-by-side track on it. We could do all these festivals, events, all these different things to bring in revenue. And the revenue was there. And so we put in an offer. I don't even remember what it was, but it was closer to like $2 million, I think. And we were going to do a syndication. So here was my thought process at this time, this point in my life was, I am part of the Bigger Pockets realm. I've built this following. I feel like I'm kind of up on this pedestal and I need to perform to that. I need to keep doing bigger and better things to keep up with the other podcast hosts and the other large investors in the area that are well known. And so that was my intention. Like the next step is doing a syndication deal. So I met with the attorney and we're like, okay, this, you know, this is how we do the syndication. I hired a guy to write all of my deal analysis to build out this huge spreadsheet for me to do deal analysis on campgrounds. And so I could put in like the way the syndication would be broken out in so many different ways between LPs and the GPs and play around with it. We went through our due diligence period and there was just so much stuff that came up. We actually had the code enforcement officer from the town call and say, hey, I've been trying to get a hold of you. I've been talking to different people. They said, you're the ones that are trying to buy this. Just so you know, the DEC is like after this place, there's all these different things. And he was actually calling us to tell us, which was
what is
so
the
grateful,
DEC?
Amazing. So we ended up like, you know what? It's going to be too much. We're going to back out of the deal. And we had put $100,000 earnest money down and we backed out like literally the day that it was up and we got our money back. And so this was 2 years ago and the property is still sitting. It still hasn't sold. And the learning experience I had from that failure was, first of all, it wasn't a failure. It was, you know, that was the opportunity cost, all the money we put into the due diligence, all the money we put into the research, all the time we put into it. We could have lost a lot more money if we went through with it. The second learning experience I had was that I don't have to scale and grow. And I honestly would probably be miserable right now if I was operating a huge, huge campground complex, especially one to that extent. And even though I can put systems in place and put people in place, like this was a whole new element for me, a whole new operational animal where it would have taken time to do all of that. And I feel like that honestly would have, yep, maybe in the long run, it would have paid off. But I feel like in my personal life, it would have set me back to what my important goals and what I want my lifestyle to actually be. So I've spent a lot of time, like I felt like awful during that time. It was like, I failed. I couldn't get this deal done. I got scared of raising the money. And so I backed out of it. And plus with all the due diligence issues. So that to me was like a failure. And it took me a while to like realize as to what I really want to do. And that's almost like I love Chad Carson, because it's like the small and mighty real estate investor, as to like, you don't have to go and buy big things and be a billionaire and all those things. Like, you can build a pretty comfortable life without having to give up, you know, your time and your energy and all this stress and go out and buy these things. So I have a lot of friends that do big syndication deals now, and honestly, listening to them, like, they are super successful and do amazing. But listening to some of the stuff they have to deal with, I just like, it makes me feel more relieved. So I have realized that I don't want a syndication deal. And part of that is because I don't want to be responsible to others. If I make a mistake, that mistake affects me personally, maybe one of my partners who has made mistakes too, and it's on both of us. But I've realized that about myself. So like, some of the failures that I have really like helped me build as to what I actually want out of my life. And is there a reason I failed at it? And was that reason because I actually didn't want it enough and didn't want it bad enough, because I knew deep down it really wasn't meant for me?
Well, I love that story. And I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago about, there's a term called the spotlight effect, where just to paraphrase for those that aren't have never heard it before, you feel like, and we have spotlights here, so it's like, this is art imitating life here, but it feels all the time, especially with social media becoming so like ingrained in everyone's life, that you're always on stage and you have to do things that you feel like other people expect you to do, or on stage is kind of what you feel like, the spotlight effect. And it seems like maybe that's what you were talking about a little bit. You felt like you had to live up to other people's expectations, even if they were just implicit, not explicit. And you were going through a process of like, I don't really want to do this, but I feel like I have to, because this is expected of me. And I think that's the fact that you recognize that and you acknowledge the struggle and the fact that it really didn't fit your goal is something that's a journey that a lot of people go through but don't actually realize. And I felt that too, or like not for the same reasons, but for different reasons. And I've made mistakes where I tried to get out of my lane that I was comfortable in and successful in, just to do things that I thought made sense, but they actually didn't. And I did it because maybe I felt like that's what I was supposed to do, just because of other people's expectations.
Next level.
Yeah. And it's a hard balance, because right, like you feel like, you know, when you go through things that you've never done before, you experience a lot of growth, and you probably learned a lot of things going through a failed experiment with the campground stuff. But thank goodness that code inspector reached out to you, because your life could have been miserable after the fact. So like, it's kind of probably a blessing in disguise, and it's probably a good thing you went through it. It sucked at the time, I'm sure. Maybe you felt like you were letting yourself down. I don't know if I'm putting my stuff on you, but like I've been through similar things, and it's difficult to live with that spotlight effect. But once you acknowledge it, recognize it's there, and you can really take that opportunity to set your own goals and be true to yourself, and decide like, that's your thing, not mine. Like, I want to do this, and I don't have to grow more than I am. Maybe I want to do other things in my life other than just like, how many units do you have? And like, you know, the whole bro hustle aspect of it. Right. So I just wanted to point that out. Like, I love that story, and the fact that you like acknowledge what you were going through and realize like, my goals are not going to be your goals no matter what. Yeah. And I want to do my own thing, and I can do my own thing within my own parameters. And that's the beauty of being an entrepreneur. And I think you lose that sometimes when you start taking advice, or maybe like implied advice from the position that you elevate yourself to. I don't know. Yeah, I just think it's cool. I think it's a cool story.
And I think part of that too is like how you're saying is, people, you know, around you saying different things or giving advice. And a big part of that was a lot of people saying to me, you have this huge opportunity with Bigger Pockets. How are you taking advantage of being on the platform? You don't have a course. You're not doing paid coaching. You know, you're not raising money. Even my private money lenders have all been within like my network already. It's not somebody, you know, I met through Bigger Pockets or Instagram or anything like that. So there was a lot of that too, is to like, man, am I like missing out on something? And I look at the things that they're doing to kind of leverage that. And it's like, wow, great. Like, you're taking advantage of that. I don't want to be on a call with somebody like trying to get them to join my coaching program or something. Like, if somebody wants help, yes. Like, I'm not going to be at your beck and call. Like, I'm not going on, but like, I will try to help you as much as I can. And like, we do the bootcamp calls with Bigger Pockets, and you know, people pay for that, but it's a very low lift. Like, I create the course content. I go through it every session, make sure we revamp some stuff. And then I do 2 calls a week during the session. And, you know, I have somebody who co-hosts it with me. I have a TA that helps answer questions, things like that. So you're not just getting my advice, you're getting other people's, but that's still all through Bigger Pockets. It's not, you know, like that I'm taking advantage of it and in doing it. So that was a hard thing too, is a lot of people saying, how are you, you know, taking advantage of your platform? And I was like, really not. I'm just doing deals.
No, I love it, Ashley. That's you're staying true to yourself and what your authentic goals are and what you want to do with your life, not being dictated by something that you're involved in or other people's aspirations that they're trying to put on you. So I really respect you a lot for that.
Yeah. My like word is being spontaneous. Like, I just want to be spontaneous. And even with you guys, my assistant had to cancel the first time we were booked because of a conflict with my kids. And that is like one thing that's really important to me, is that I have the flexibility in my schedule. It's not very often that I commit to something that I don't have the flexibility to move it if something comes up with the kids' schedule, or like, I know the kids are coming, or like, I know it's going to be a good time to take care of this because it's while they're at school or whatever. So that is like a big thing for me too, is being able to have that flexibility, having a spontaneous day and not having it be exactly like the same as it was when I was an accountant sitting at a desk, you know, doing people's taxes over and over again.
Ashley, every time we have a property manager on, I always like to ask a question, if you have had any crazy or weird investment stories, something that you found in a property or seen happen at a property. I feel like the property managers always have the wildest things to say. So what is the wildest thing that you've come across or a story you've seen?
So this was not even my property. I was in Seattle at a real estate meetup. Or actually, it wasn't even a meetup. It was during COVID, and it was like the first event after COVID. And they just had the speakers attend, and there was, they did it virtual, but they had all of the speakers there, and you go like into a little booth and talk. And then like afterwards, you know, all the speakers would hang out. And the one local investor there said, let's go to one of my properties. I just bought this hoarder house. So we all pile into his SUV and we go to this hoarder house. I mean, it's just packed. I've never been inside a house like this before. And there's like in the bedrooms, just stuff everywhere. But there was so much of like 50 boxes of unopened lipstick, 50 boxes of wigs. Well, now people are taking out these wigs out of the packaging, putting them on their heads and all this stuff and going crazy in the house. So then we go down into the basement, and it was an older lady that he had bought the house from. She had passed away, and the one relative sold it to him.
You found the body in the basement?
No. Okay. So we go into the basement, and there's this room like off the back of the basement. It has human-sized bird cages in it. It's like 4 of them, huge bird cages in there. And it's just like, okay, this is really weird. So then we're going in and we find a bedroom. The bedroom appears to be like her adult son that lived there. We start finding boxes of toys, and large toys, different colored toys. And then we go to like the living room area that's downstairs. There is this big, huge, old like TV that has like the big back end on it, you know, and a big,
like a console TV, like sits on the floor. Yeah,
yeah.
I have one of those. Yeah.
And it has, there's VHS tapes. And so we pop in one of the VHS tapes.
Of course you pop one in.
It is not appropriate. There's pictures out there somewhere of us standing in front of the TV like, oh my God, what is happening? But it was 2 men, and they were doing things. And it was just like a whole collection of just all of this porn and toys and all this stuff. And there's the mom living upstairs and her adult son with all of this stuff downstairs.
Were the videos home? Were the videos homemade?
So then I don't know about that. So then I'd be like, oh yeah, that's actually that room right there. No. Then there was, so somebody took one of the toys and one of the girl investors who also lived in the area was driving her Tesla through town. And when we were leaving the hoarder house, they stuck one on the back of her car. So as she's driving, we're driving behind her and it's just flopping.
That sounds like something we would do.
I human-sized bird cages? Were these incorporated in the like video the at all? Like, I'm just... What's...
You didn't watch that much video.
Okay. Wow. That is... That's...
This is why
I've never heard anything like
that. That's why it's my
favorite question to ask. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's a perfect lead into our ending here.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that,
I tried to be as delicate as I could with the words I was using. Fine. I don't know if this will be allowed.
Yeah, we love that. It's perfect.
Well, probably 90% of our listeners have dropped off by now anyway. So the 10% of the depraved people got still good, listening.
Just got the juicy stuff.
Yeah, they got the good stuff. So we have one last section of our episode here that we like to cover that we lovingly call the OT with Owen and Ted. And we've got the same questions that we ask every guest each week. Are you ready for these bad boys? I know we got sent them, or we sent them to you a little bit late. So, yeah, you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I have my notes right here in case I forget, but I think I remember all the answers.
All right. So this one, the first one is obviously a little bit of a cheat for you since you already have one. But we normally ask, what would the title of your first book be called or about? But my follow-up question to that is, well, actually, I'll let you answer that, and then I have a follow-up question.
Okay, so my first book would be Real Estate Rookie, 90 Days to Your First Investment.
Perfect. And that can be found on, that was a Bigger Pockets publishing book, but you can also find that on Amazon or any other.
It's in Barnes & Noble, too, yeah. And if you do buy it on Bigger Pockets, you can use the code Ashley, and I think it's like 10% off or something.
And, nice. And if you're listening to us locally, the event that we will hold locally right after this podcast release, Ashley autographed a handful of books for us at the last BPCon. So we'll make sure we give one of those away at our local meetup.
Thanks,
also.
Guys. Yeah. Awesome.
Okay. So the follow-up question for this is, what's your second book going to be called or about?
Well, I actually have a second book. It is called Real Estate Partnerships. And it is co-authored with Tony Robinson. Yeah,
I just finished that a couple weeks ago, by the way.
Yeah, thank you. Did you like it?
Yes.
Well, thanks for making me look like a dumbass by asking that question, Ted.
But I did write down another answer for if there's a third book.
Okay. All right. Perfect. What is the third book going to be called or about?
I would probably do something about like systems and processes. Okay. How to build out SOPs, maybe. I'm like super into that right now. And so I think that would be.
Actually, you know, we've had a lot of book authors on, but I never asked, is it lucrative to write the books?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
I mean, Jay Scott gave us a little bit insight on that. He's like, I think he's self-published.
Well, he seems to be a glutton for punishment. He's got like 20 books out now, but
they're not profitable. I don't know what he's doing.
But it's also of that, like, it brings people to you and gives you something to give people.
Yeah. You've got a platform to like talk about things on and you can go invest in gigantic campgrounds because that's what you should do. Right. yeah. No, I did want to add, this is a off script a little bit, but like now you've gotten to be friends with several Bigger Pockets influencers, including Jay Scott. You were recently on Drunk Real Estate, which I'm a huge fan of that podcast. Now, how did that happen? You're located in Buffalo, New York. You're in close proximity to, I believe, the Wilson family. Is that right?
Yeah, they live in Philadelphia, and Ashley Wilson has become my best friend. So when I don't know if you listened to the episode recently where Kyle talked about the dogs and how his wife and her friends are like a pack of dogs.
That's kind of like a cautionary tale. Like, yeah, that's a cautionary tale for podcast hosts. Like, this is not how you should talk about wives and females in your life. Who's comparing?
So I had actually, he was talking about me and then our other friend Serena that came to visit, because I've come before, or Serena has come, but we've never come together. And he described it exactly, like it was chaos. And then he ended up and just came, they both came with their kids and visited me last weekend. So it was kind of funny to just throw the dog comment out at him.
Well, so they live in Philadelphia. That's obviously, well, not for people in the Midwest, but now that I know that, like, if they live in Philadelphia, that's nowhere even close to where you live, right?
No,
that's
it's a 6-hour drive.
Yeah, that's a long ways. Yeah. So, yeah, I stand corrected on that one as well.
That's where Matt Faircloth is too, right?
Philly?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think so.
Yeah, it sounds right. Yeah, positive, sounds right. that's funny, though. You have something. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Ted. He's giving me the eye.
You're so used to talking today. I might get my chance today.
I'm just excited.
Okay, so Ashley, you can interview anybody in the world today that's alive on your podcast. Who is it going to be? And what's the one dying question you want to ask?
So it would be Alex Cooper. Do you guys know who that is?
I don't. Is that Alice Cooper's son?
No. So Alex Cooper is the podcast host of Call Her Daddy. Right now, she competes with Joe Rogan for having the number one or number two podcast. Two years ago, she got a $60 million Spotify deal to be exclusive with them. Dang. She started her podcast and her apartment in New York City, and she has just built this massive empire through her podcast. So she has what she calls her daddy gang and stuff. So her podcast is not anything real estate, but I would love to interview her to see what she did to actually build this following in this community, like the loyalty of the people that just like want to consume her content. Is just crazy. It's just crazy. And she started out just like talking about her own real life experiences. And now she has a lot of famous guests on. But one thing that I've always admired is that these guests that she has on have done a million interviews, a million. But she always finds something that makes this interview different than any other one that they've ever done. So I just like admire the way that she's kind of like built her platform and built her, you know, $1 million, I'm sure eventually $1 billion business.
So what have you learned from that to apply to your podcast?
That we don't have as large of a sense of community that she does. This was the first time I went to go visit the Wilsons in Philadelphia. She did like a 6-week tour through different cities, maybe did 7 cities, I think it was, over that course of the time. Where here's a podcast host that says, I'm coming to your city live, buy tickets. You didn't know what it was going to be. Was it going to be a live podcast? What was happening? Almost every single show sold out. So I was like, I've got to see what she is doing for a live show as a podcast host. And it was crazy. It was like a theatrical performance. It was an interview. Like, she brought in like a surprise guest of a famous person. Like Dave Portnoy was one of the nights. Then, you know, she brought on, you know, her dog who everybody loves in the community. And then she was getting married this year. So she's like, everybody, this is my bachelorette party. And she like popped champagne. And it was just like all of these different things happened that like, it was like shock, shock, shock value after each other. And it was like, here's a podcast host doing something different. Like, Joe Rogan does his shows, but it's comedy. You know, it's what he knows and what he does and what you expect. But this was so different. And so I think the way that she really like brings in her community, that they're willing to go and buy tickets to see her, even though they have no idea what's going to happen. They just want to be around her. So I think that's like super interesting.
I remember when we tried doing a live cast once and 3 people came to the room.
That is true. Yeah, it was really good though. I feel like we definitely performed despite the audience.
Great interview. Yeah,
I feel like we did okay. That's funny. Okay, next question for you, Ashley. Who would you choose to deliver your eulogy, and what do you hope they're going to say about you?
So I would hope it would be my kids, because I made the greatest impact on their life and they were the people that were closest to me. So I would want it to be them that wanted to. It's to like, no one else is talking about our mom. We are going to do this. And what I would want them to say is like how much of an impact I had on their lives and how proud they were of me and how much they respect me and that they were happy off of the millions and millions of dollars I left them.
Through the book sale.
Yeah. Only a million more books to sell.
that 30 cents of her book still comes in, Mom. Thank you.
You're like, Mom, we're good. We took some cans back to the store. We exceeded your book sales.
Ashley, throughout your life, not necessarily in real estate, but just your life in general, who's been the biggest mentor in your life to give a shout out to, and what impact have they had on you personally or your business career?
Yeah, so it would definitely have to be that investor I started working out for, Carl. I dedicated my first book to him. And since I partner with his son on a lot of things, and he's one of my really good friends, I made sure to put just Mr. Emmerling in like who my book was written to. And I always tell my business partner, you'll never know who it was for, but it was for his
dad. now the secret's out.
That's great.
Yeah. So I've learned a lot of things from him. And I've also learned a lot of things not to do from him, of the way he's done business. So I just really have a lot of respect for him from things he's gone through in his life and the businesses he's had and managed. But most of all, giving me the opportunity to be a part of that, I'm so grateful for.
Well, and he's obviously, that's worked out pretty damn well for him as well. So it's a good example of taking a chance on somebody that's maybe inexperienced, but has good core values and high intellect and a drive to succeed. I just wanted to make that comment again. I know we mentioned it earlier, but like hiring for, talent and integrity is going to trump, I think, hiring for skills a lot of times. Yeah. Probably 9 times out of 10. So I do like that. It does take more work and training and everything else, but I think in the long run, it weighs out to be a more beneficial approach to it. So I do have another question for you here. This is kind of to put a bow on this. What are you looking for in your business right now, or, your life, where somebody catching this episode might be able to, help you, connect you with somebody that for something you're looking for, or maybe what are you excited about in your business right now?
Yeah. So the thing I'm excited about is that I hired a consultant who has been helping me build out my SOPs, like even more detail oriented. So she's literally taking like my Word documents and my Monday boards and putting them into Tango and creating. And then she is meeting with like my maintenance person, my leasing agent, and she's going through and being like, okay, let's build this out together. What should we change? What actually works? What doesn't? Instead of me having to sit on a grueling Zoom call, be like, okay, go through your process, what you do. Like, I know what they're doing. I just don't want to sit and go through the detail of it. Like, them two together building it out, it works. It works great. So we're continuously picking, like, you know what? This week, we're going to do this little, and it's like literally a little tiny thing as to, somebody's moving out. What is the process? Or not the whole move out. Like, what is the process for sending them the move out instructions? And it's like, okay, we're going to do these contact points and these. So just breaking down like every little task that can come up and building out kind of SOPs for that has been what I'm excited about. What I want to do, which I haven't really done, is kind of do like a newsletter that's going out. So I have a VA that's been helping me get my website better and things like that. And she sent out like a couple mailings, but I want to be able to give out some free content and just build an email list in case there ever is a blackout or something and Instagram goes down, I can still connect with everyone. But that's, I would say, something that I'm definitely going to need help on is writing the newsletter and creating it. I know exactly like how I want it, but it's more of just like the design and somebody actually plugging it in every week and sending it out.
Yeah. Do you have of the like social media platforms out there, is Instagram your, is that your jam normally? Like, is, if somebody wanted to reach out to you, is that the best way?
Yeah. Instagram. Yeah.
Perfect.
And we'll link that in the show notes along with your website too. So appreciate that. Ashley, I first met you at the BPCon in New Orleans, and you were so kind and open, and we got some great pictures. You probably don't remember, but I'll tag them. I'll tag you in them. But
was I hula hooping? Because that's the only picture anyone ever talks about is me hula hooping on stage at the New Orleans.
I think it was on the, when we were all walking back from Bourbon Street, and we're all half tanked.
Were we with the cardboard cutout of Brandon Turner? Because I remember that from
Ryan Murdoch had that. I think.
Yeah, we had video of Ryan running around with it, and then we like asked Ryan some questions about it. I had no idea who.
Who has that now?
No,
who has it?
The Wilsons. No,
really? Oh my God!
Kyle and Ashley Wilson. Yeah.
Ryan's like, take this on the plane with you, man. It'll be perfect. It'll still be priceless. I'm like, there's no way this thing's going with me.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, they have it now.
That's hilarious. Again, thank you so much. You've always been so kind. And then running into you at every BP since then, you've always just been open arms, and I just appreciate you and what you do, and I appreciate what you do for our rookie community. So thank you so much.
Yeah, and, thank you. Are you guys going to be in Cancun this year for the?
Oh yeah, I'll be there. Yeah. Dad's going too. Yeah. He just hasn't booked it yet.
I haven't booked yet, but I'll be there.
No, it's going to be exciting. I do want to point out though, there's something weird about when you go slightly out of the country where people get funny about like, they're like, I don't know if my wife or husband's going to be cool with that. And it's like, it's literally just right across the board. Like, what is the difference? Yeah. Like, do you know what I'm saying about that? Like, we're like, whoa, you're going to Mexico? Whoa, that's a whole different thing. Why? What does it matter? It's the same thing.
It's a spouse thing. It's your spouse is like, you're going to a beach without me pretty much. And like, my spouse is a teacher and she can't go. And she's not happy that she won't be able to go to Mexico.
That's my point. Yeah. It's like, people, they get all like butthurt about just because it happens to be like a little south of Texas or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I've never understood that.
We generally, in our local RIA group, we get 20 to 30 people coming with us to every event so far since the first one I attended. I know you went to Tennessee first, but I guarantee you that we'll probably have like 10 people on this next one.
Yeah. It's just weird to me. Like, I've never understood the whole like fall off of like, well, I can't really go because I'm going to be in a cool place and you know, I don't have anybody with me. It's like, we're going to talk about real estate. Like, you're still not going to like it. Like, there's no difference between this and going to Nashville or like New Orleans or whatever. Like, they're all fun places, but it's there for real estate. It's nonstop.
I told her she needs to go.
Yeah. Okay. He caved.
Well, Onwe, you want to see us out of here?
Yep. On behalf of RIA Radio, the absent Dennis Bertrand, our producer, and Ted Kosh, I'm Owen Dashner. You've been listening to Ashley Building Wealth Through House Hacking Human-Sized Birdcages. Hair. Signing off. Ashley, thanks so much. We really appreciate you coming on. Sorry to take up so much of your time today, but this was a lot of fun. I felt like we talked about a lot of good, really good content here, and I think listeners are going to get a lot out of this. So,
thank you so much for having me.
You bet.
We make sure you're fully uploaded. I have my sent off right now.
Yeah, it's at 99.